So good evening, everybody. Let's start with our motivation. So the Buddha was once like us, an ordinary sentient being, not able to understand the Dharma, lots of afflictions clouding his mind stream. So exactly like us. But then he was able to meet the Dharma, generate the bodhicitta, practice very diligently, and through realizing the nature of reality, employ that realization to purify his mind stream of all defilements and become fully enlightened. So we have the example of the Buddha, who started out where we are and succeeded in abandoning all that was to be abandoned and cultivating all that is to be cultivated and attaining the final goal. And so, since the nature of our mind is no different from that of the Buddha's mind, then we can do the same thing. So it just takes our wanting to do it, our aspiration, and then exerting the effort and the continuity, the persistence of the practice without going up and down and in and out and high and low, but just doing it step by step. And so if we follow that procedure, which is the same one the Buddha himself followed, then we can attain the same result. So it's important to remember that, to think about that, and to approach the teachings with that kind of confidence. And that kind of aspiration to really make our life highly meaningful. And not only this life, but all lives highly meaningful for the benefit of all beings. And in that way, to banish all discouragement and that mind that feels sorry for ourselves and says we can't do it and it's too hard and blah blah. But really having an optimistic, you know, I'm going to do it mind. And then just step by step, gradually, gently, but consistently, practicing the path. Remember that the mind that's discouraged is the mind of affliction. That discouragement is part of laziness. So we can take an awful lot of energy and put it into being lazy. Can't we? Can't we? It takes energy to be lazy. Doesn't it? Yeah, it takes a lot of energy to be lazy, so let's redirect that energy to something useful. Okay, so there were several questions here. So I'll read them out. We'll see if you can figure them out together. Okay. So what is the focal object of a cognizer mistakenly apprehending something that does not exist at all? For example, the Klingon emperor. Emperor. I don't know what the Klingon emperor. Oh, okay. So what is the focal object of a cognizer mistakenly apprehending something that does not exist, like the Klingon Emperor. Was folklore.
First, you have to convince me that the Klingon Emperor doesn't exist.
Well, how do we tell that? What is going to determine whether something exists or not?
Perceived by mind.
Yeah, if it's perceived by a valid mind, not just any old mind. Okay, by a reliable mind. Okay, so what's the focal object of that cognizer that mistakenly apprehends?
That would be the Klingon, the Emperor.
Or whatever character is costumed as the Emperor.
Klingon Emperor.
What's the focal object?
Well, the appearing object is that. The apprehended object is that. The focal object has to be the...
The mistake, yeah.
Okay. So is the thing that you're mistaking for the Klingon Emperor, you know? Or if there's nothing that you're mistaking as being that character and it's just a total figment of your imagination, then what is the focal object?
Imagination. And what's that conceived for the particular context?
What is the focal object of something that of a cognizer cognizing something that doesn't exist?
There isn't one.
Okay, if the appearing objects of direct cognizers are impermanent phenomena, and the appearing objects of conceptual cognizers are permanent phenomena, then what perceives consciousness and abstract composites? If the appearing objects of direct cognizers are impermanent phenomena, and the appearing objects of conceptual cognizers are permanent phenomena, then what kind of cognizer perceives consciousnesses and abstract composites?
Because they're impermanent. Both of those.
Yeah, they're both impermanent.
And they're existent things.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're existent things. So.
Direct cognizer.
Yeah, so there's going to be some kind of direct, reliable cognizer that apprehends them. Mm-hmm. What's this person's problem? Why are they making a mistake? Why do they have this question?
Because the consciousness isn't a form that you can see.
Yeah. Because they're thinking impermanent phenomena just means sensory objects. They're forgetting that there's three different kinds of impermanent phenomena.
Okay. Abstract composites is one.
Yeah, and consciousness is one, and abstract composites is one. Okay, so that's the problem that person has. Okay. Okay, so let's look at a general image of something, like Venerable's example of breakfast. When apprehending something as general as breakfast with a conceptual consciousness, while the object that is vividly appearing to the mind is oatmeal, pancakes, or toast, what is going on here? Are the appearing and apprehended objects rapidly changing? That is, from oatmeal to toast to breakfast, depending upon what appears to the mind at a given moment? Or perhaps is the conceptual appearance of breakfast a composite of all the various types of breakfasts we've had, so that when oatmeal and then toast appears, they are apprehended as all in relationship to the notion of breakfast, and thus getting at the apprehended object of breakfast? You want to translate it into English? Okay, let me give it a shot for translating. Okay, so you're thinking about breakfast. Yeah. So what is appearing to your mind when you're thinking about breakfast? A conceptual image of breakfast. Okay. Now, what's your conceptual input? appearance or image of breakfast appearance.
Whatever Jack made yesterday that we'll have in the morning.
Okay, when somebody says breakfast, what do you think about?
I think just about the table and all the stuff on it.
So it's a whole bunch of stuff in general stuff. Okay, and what do you think about?
Granola.
You think about granola. What do you think about?
Cottage cheese.
Cottage cheese. What do you think about?
Grapefruit and yogurt.
Okay, grapefruit and yogurt. So when you hear breakfast, everybody's going to have a different conceptual appearance to the mind. Okay? So your conceptual appearance may be, like, you know, yours was just the table full of all different kinds of things. So that's the object, is the table full of all kinds of things. Now within that, if you start looking, oh, there's pancakes. Oh, we should only be so lucky to have pancakes here. Where's Kevin? I haven't had pancakes with Kevin. So if your conceptual appearance goes from pancakes, and then you see toast, and then you see oatmeal, and then you see granola, okay, are you having different conceptual appearances?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And that is different than when you just have the whole general one of breakfast. Okay? So you're going to have... And then if you're thinking pancakes and then toast, and which do I want? And, oh, Jack said there's pink grapefruit with cottage cheese. Because you forgot it was two different people who said it, so... Now you have pink grapefruit with cottage cheese at the top of it. So, what a combo. I'll take pancakes. You know, so you're going to have all sorts of different appearing objects according to what you're specifically thinking about. And it may go back and forth between one thing or another, you know. Okay, like when you sit at a restaurant and you have the menu and you're looking at all the different things there are for breakfast. You might go through and imagine each thing, yeah? And you imagine each thing, and you have a visual and a taste image, and, you know, it's not just a visual image, but what's that going to taste like? What's the texture in my mouth? What's it going to smell like? Okay, how's it going to feel when I eat it? And you're going to kind of try each one out, aren't you, when you're looking at the menu? Yeah? And it's all going on conceptually in your mind. You're gonna have a whole breakfast before you've ordered anything. And then you think, oh, this one will make me happy. Mm-hmm. And you order that one because you have a conceptual appearance of that one that seems to give you some good feeling. Right? Then you get whatever it was you ordered. Okay. So you get the pancakes. And it's Venerable Semke who made the pancakes, so they're very dark brown. Bordering on burnt. So then, is there some disparity between your conceptual image and your direct perception? You bet. Okay, and it's because of that disparity that there was attachment arising towards the conceptual image of the pancakes. When you see the actual pancakes, you know, you wish you had ordered pink grapefruit and cottage cheese. Okay? Yeah.
Doesn't that happen even if there isn't a big disparity? I mean, it seems like even if it's perfectly fine, still it doesn't seem to always match what you conjured up in your mind.
Exactly, exactly. We've conjured something up in our mind, what it's going to be like. And the actual direct perception of it never matches the conceptual appearance. Sometimes we make the conceptual appearance, exaggerate it, and it's going to be really wonderful. Sometimes the conceptual appearance is like pink grapefruit and cottage cheese. You know, but then it comes, but then you like it, you know. So you can see here how attachment and anger arise when we exaggerate our conceptual appearance, makes it look better than it is, yeah, then we're going to have attachment for it. Yeah, when it makes it look less than it is, we're going to have aversion for it. Okay.
So, Venerable, is breakfast a different type of appearing object than a specific?
Say that again?
Well, when we said breakfast, is that different now that we've kind of honed in and become more specific? Is there a different type of process that's going on in the mind from generality of breakfast to... Are they all appearing objects, whether it's breakfast?
Well, remember we were saying that you could have... here. I mean, you have to specify whether we're talking about direct perception or a conceptual consciousness. Okay. Because, you know, when you have a conceptual appearance, there's just the general appearance of breakfast. Okay. Which could be the table with all the different things on it. Or it could be, you know, whatever breakfast means to you.
Okay. So it doesn't matter what word you use. It's just...
Yeah, everybody's going to have a slightly different image. That's why I asked you, you know, what when you say breakfast, what image appears to your mind? Everybody's going to have a slightly different one. And everybody's probably going to have a different one on different days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And just like when we have a precept day, and you have conceptual appearance of breakfast, and then there is no breakfast. Yeah? Then you see what happens. Okay. So you can see how a lot of, you know, it's very interesting to watch these things, and at what point does attachment or aversion arise, you know, depending on either the direct perception or the conceptual mind making up some image of what it's going to be like. And this relates very much, we were talking after lunch, you know, because we had had the BBCs about trust, that when you get married, you develop a conceptual appearance of who this, a conception of who this person is. Yeah? And you may make certain areas them far exaggerated, or other areas deprecated. But it's never going to be exactly what the person is, because the person themselves is changing moment by moment, and it's going to be hard to pinpoint what they are anyway, especially since they don't have a fixed personality. Yeah, but then when you put in the conceptual mind that is, you know, painting pictures, then yeah, you can see why there's problems that develop.
We do that here.
Oh, yeah. We do that here.
Part of our practice is to realize that we do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do it here. I mean, you can see some people, you know, before they move here, they have one idea of the Abbey and what it's going to be like to live at the Abbey. And then they move here, and it's like, oh, it's not like that. Yeah? Because when you're a guest and you know, you only come for time to time, then everybody says hello and how are you and pays a lot of attention to you. Yeah? And everybody appreciates you and says, thank you so much for doing this. And, you know, we appreciate your offerings and you did this, you know, at home that helped us, and thank you very much. And, you know, right? Yeah? And then you move here, and you're at the stand-up meeting every morning, and, you know, and you have to say what you're doing, and people are going, well, you said you were doing that the last 5 days. Why haven't you finished it yet? Yeah? Why every day is Terry working on the meditation hall and I never see her out there working on it?
You're always in your cabin.
Working on a book.
You know? And so you had this image of, you know, it's going to be so wonderful and these people are so great and I'm going to be the center of attention, and then you move here and it's not like that, is it? Yeah? And it's like, you know, you didn't do your chores. Donnie's looking at you. You know, it was chore day yesterday. You didn't do your chores. Whereas before, when you did your, you vacuumed, everybody was going, oh, thank you so much for vacuuming. We really appreciate it. Yeah, right? Yeah? So then, you know, then you feel like, oh, what happened? I mean, this is supposed to be like this, and it's not like this. And, you know, so who cheated you? Our own mind. Our own mind cheated us, didn't it? Yeah. It built up some kind of unrealistic expectation and then got upset when reality didn't match.
I hardly ever noticed that part.
Which part?
Who cheated us.
Oh, yes. We don't notice the who cheated us part because we're so convinced that our conception seems to be so much like reality that we don't realize it was just an image in our mind. We thought, oh, but it was like this, and now how come it's not continuing to be like this? They betrayed me. Now look at them. They're monastics. They betray my trust. Yeah? And it's completely in our own mind. Yeah? We don't guarantee people are going to live happily ever after here. We guarantee you're going to work on your mind and, you know, have internal civil wars inside yourself.
We should put that on the website.
Nobody will come if we put it on the website. Yeah. Would you three come if we said Well, when you're a guest, you don't have the internal civil wars, you know. Yeah. It's when you come here and we get to know you better and, you know, and you start with the same old excuses that used to work when you were a visitor. Mm. And now when you live here, those excuses don't work anymore. Yeah. You remember that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You remember the good old days. The good old days when you were a guest at the Abbey.
So simple.
Yeah. Everybody was so nice. Okay. So this person says, I raise this question because it seems to be relevant to meditation on equanimity. I notice that when I try to meditate on and thus apprehend all sentient beings in this meditation, what typically might appear to my mind are the birds I hear chirping outside, whichever dear ones happen to be on my mind, and maybe a hell being. Are these sufficient to get at the apprehended object of all sentient beings, themselves being mere components of the larger composite? Or is it, I think, the more likely possibility, that I've never correctly meditated on equanimity? Yeah. But then, without the conceptual appearance of specific beings, what appears is a mere fuzz, which doesn't seem as helpful. Yeah. How then to actually apprehend all sentient beings? Is the meditation on equanimity, wherein we gradually extend our focus from dear ones to strangers to enemies, effectively building our conceptual appearance of all sentient beings so that it eventually can come to be an appearance through which we can genuinely apprehend them? This is a good question, isn't it? It's really taking these teachings and applying them to your Dharma practice. Yeah? So what do you think? Yes? Yeah? What do you think when you're meditating on equanimity? Or let's say you're meditating on love and compassion for all sentient beings. Because on equanimity, you're going to start out imagining a friend, imagining a stranger. You know, there you're going to have specific people. Okay? At the end, when you've broken down those categories, then you want to see all sentient beings as equal in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. So then what is this conceptual appearance of all sentient beings? So what is it for you? What do you think of when you... What appears to your mind when we say all sentient beings?
To me, it's the feeling that that we're the same, so getting in touch with what's inside of me and knowing that's in every other being.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's useful to have specific images of different people or different beings, and also to be in touch with my own experience of what I'm trying to say, if it's affection or love, or because then I have to infer.
Yeah. So if you, there you're talking about doing the meditation in general, that you're in touch with your own experience and see that others have the same feeling. But just about when we say a conceptual appearance of all sentient beings, what appears to your mind? What do you get?
For me, I imagine behind me and all down through the valley and all the way to Newport, and so I just have people sitting like we're sitting.
Mm-hmm.
I do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And all, and then the feeling thing is important, and that we're all looking at the merit field with, you know, this heart, mm-hmm. and to try and generate. But I just feel space up with.
Yeah. And are they all human beings?
No. All kinds of every.
All kinds of different living beings. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And how about you?
I try to bring everyone in. I often do, I think because the way I see things, a lot of times I see movement.
Mm-hmm.
So I oftentimes think of things that people are doing. So everyone who's sitting on a bus, everyone who's on a subway, everyone who's on a subway,
okay.
everyone who's here. And I just do that for like a few minutes of kind of everyone in a hospital, everyone who's walking right now, everyone who's in an airplane.
Okay, so what you'll do is you'll take many conceptual appearances of everyone who's in a plane, everyone who's in a hospital, everybody who's walking, and then kind of glue them together in a way. Okay, what do other people have when you say think of all sentient beings? What comes to your mind?
I think of three kinds of suffering that all beings are experiencing.
No, I say just all sentient beings. What conceptual? I'm not regarding the meditation right now. It's just when we say all sentient beings, what appears to your mind?
Well, then I have to go according to groups because I can't bring them all in yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I might just.
So you do different groups too,
right.
But you do you do the groups according to the different types of sentient beings?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I might focus on one session with hell beings.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so according to the different types, which I found out it isn't different. When you talk about the six ones, it's not six realms, it's six types of sentient beings.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's three realms, but they, you know, this is what Geshe-la was saying yesterday. We often say six realms, it's actually six types of sentient beings.
Huh.
Okay. But it's interesting. So some people may take it by the six types of sentient beings and glue them together. Mm-hmm. You take them by different activities they're doing and glue them together. Yeah. You imagine them all sitting around here. Yeah. So just even when we say all sentient beings, we're all getting a slightly different thing. And we all may do a slightly different process to get that feeling of like numberless sentient beings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, we certainly aren't going to have a conceptual appearance of every single one of them individually, are we?
Yeah.
Yeah. So at a certain point, they all become faceless in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But we just know, okay, there's all these sentient beings out there. I don't know who they are. But then it's very interesting, you know, because I notice when different people come here, then I think, oh, you know, they were one of the faceless sentient beings.
Mm-hmm.
And now I know them, and there's one sentient being, you know, kind of that you can put a face to, except I usually forget them afterwards. But, you know, still there's a feeling of, oh, you know, they've gone from being just kind of somebody in the vast audience to, oh, some sentient being I know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which creates a different feeling, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay, so the thing is, I think what he's also asking is when you have a conceptual appearance of a group of things, what does that mean? Does it mean you have to see every single individual part of that group?
No.
No, you can just have the general appearance of that entire group.
Just is the same as visualizing a deity, and we get hung up.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Visualizing, you know, if you want to visualize the Buddha, are you going to, do you have to have every single detail to visualize the Buddha? No. Okay. So same thing when you look out the window and you see a landscape. You see all these different things there, but you may not individually identify them. Because the impression to you is just the whole landscape. Okay? So I thought that was quite a good question, you know? And this is the way I think we should use these teachings, not just kind of abstract stuff, but, you know, well, how does it apply to what my mind is perceiving now? Okay. Okay, so the idea here is an eye consciousness perceiving a white snow mountain as blue. What's the appearing object? And sometimes we said it was a white snow mountain, and sometimes we said it was a blue snow mountain. And, you know, what I finally came to in reading the different things is that they usually say it's a white snow mountain appearing as a blue snow mountain. That's the appearing object. They don't give you a specific thing. It's one thing appearing as another. Yeah? Okay. So, when you perceive, you look in the distance and there's a mirage and you see water, it's a mirage appearing as water that's the appearing object. Mm-hmm. Apprehended object is water. Focal object is
mirage.
Okay. Okay, then the next one. In the case of permanent space, permanent space is both the appearing object to the conception apprehending it, and I think we need to reword this. Permanent space is the appearing object to the conception apprehending it, and the conceptual appearance of space is also the appearing object to that conception apprehending it. Is it the appearing object to the same conception apprehending it? Okay. When you have a conception, yeah, apprehending permanent space, okay, what is the appearing object?
Conceptual appearance of permanent space.
Well, that's if you're thinking. That's one way. If you're, I think, actively thinking, what is permanent space? But what about if you just think permanent space? Can permanent space be the appearing object to a conception?
Yes.
Why?
Because it's permanent.
Because it's permanent. And what's the appearing object to conception?
Permanent
phenomena. So space can be the appearing object to a conception of space. To a conception of space. Mm-hmm. Can't it?
I don't understand that at all, because I thought all your conceptions, all the appearing objects, always had to be conceptual appearance.
Now, is that true?
Well, that's the question,
okay, so is that true? That is, are conceptual appearances the only things that appear to conceptions?
As the appearing object.
As the appearing object.
No.
Is that the only thing? No.
No.
Because when we say, what is the appearing object to conception, what's the answer?
It's the appearing object permanent. To conception.
To conception, permanent phenomena. So are there more permanent phenomena besides conceptual appearances?
Yes.
Yes. What you're thinking of is if a sense object is going to appear to a conception, then you have to have the conceptual appearance of the sense object. Okay.
I'm thinking, why in that system do they go through this rigmarole about how you realize emptiness, because it's a permanent phenomenon? Yeah. So can't they see it? You're saying, with what you're saying here, that there would be no reason why they couldn't.
Well, yeah. I mean,
so
they...
It's just like it blows apart reasoning.
Yeah. Well, except they say that in the Satantrika, to realize selflessness, you realize it implicitly, not directly.
Right. Because yeah. Direct things realize impermanent things.
Right.
But even just to have that yeah. conceptual appearance. Well,
yeah, so the conceptual appearance would be of selflessness for the Satantrikas, but that wouldn't be the full realization of selflessness. Because you want to have a concept, you want to have a direct perception of something for the deepest level of understanding of selflessness. But because they say selflessness is permanent, you can't have a direct perception of it. So they say what you have is a direct perception of impermanent phenomena that are changing, 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 and implicitly you know that there's no self in them. Okay, but that's this particular system.
The way you just said it made sense.
Hmm?
The way you just said it actually made
yeah.
sense.
Uh-huh.
What's the definition of conception?
Okay, what's a conceptual mind?
One that relies on the conceptual
appearance. One that
you have it not relying on a conceptual appearance, no.
No, no, conceptual mind is one that apprehends permanent phenomena. So the thing you're thinking of is that if it's a permanent phenomenon, it has to be a conceptual appearance. That's not correct.
That's where
you're getting hung up.
Well,
yeah.
What I'm getting hung up is when we talked about the horn of a rabbit last week and said not an object of conception in general, but can be an object of conception for that particular conception
right.
apprehending it. So conception's got a verb, which means that conception's doing something like apprehending.
No, they're just distinguishing, you know, the rabbit's horn is not an object of apprehension of conception in general because
right.
it doesn't exist.
Right.
But if you have a specific mind that is thinking of a rabbit's horn, okay.
So particular conception means a particular mind.
A particular mind.
That's what I mean. A conception is somewhat synonymous.
That particular mind
that is
apprehending a rabbit's horn. Yeah. Okay.
So that can be an object of conception.
Yeah. Well.
See, I'm getting confused.
Yeah.
Conception. I want to say mind.
Yeah.
Particular mind.
Okay. When you have a conception of a rabbit's horn,
mm-hmm.
okay, to that mind, how was it they said it? Read it again.
The horn of a rabbit is not an object of conception in general, but can be an object of conception for that particular conception
mind.
Apprehending.
Yeah, so for that particular conception that's thinking rabbit's horn, okay, then you can say that
it is an object of that mind,
but it's not an object in general.
It's a conceptual object.
But what I'm getting at is when they say particular conception,
it means one particular mind.
Mind.
When you're sitting there thinking rabbit horn.
Okay, it's not a thought. It's the mind is actually apprehending it. It's a particular.
A
mind.
Thought is a mind apprehending it. A thought is a consciousness. See, it's interesting because in English, do we think of thought as the consciousness apprehending it, or do we think of a thought as the object that's being apprehended?
That's the object.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we both.
But we use it in both ways, don't we?
Yeah.
It can mean, thought can sometimes mean the subject and sometimes mean the object.
And in this place, it's the subject.
It's the subject. Okay, let's go on. Okay, so if we look at the text by Geshe Jhampa Sampal, okay, presentation of mind and awareness, composite of all the important points, opener of the eye of new intelligence. Okay, so he says, having bowed down to the glorious Losang Drakpa, who's Losang Drakpa?
Jay Tsongkhapa,
okay. Emanation of Manjugosha. Who's Manjugosha?
Manjushri.
Treasury of wisdom. I extend this presentation of mind and awareness, composite of all the important points in order to increase the clarity of knowledge of those with low intelligence.
Yay.
Do you volunteer? Okay, the presentation of mind and awareness has three parts. One definition, two divisions, three the meaning of each division. It's very helpful to memorize the definitions, by the way. Okay, so definitions. A knower, okay, so this is a technical term. Knower is the definition of a mind. Okay, so if somebody says, what is a mind? You say, a knower. If they say, what's a knower? It's a mind. Okay. That which is clear in knowing, or another translation, luminous and aware, is the definition of a consciousness. The three, mind, awareness, or knower, and consciousness, are synonymous. Okay, so there's three terms there that all mean the same thing. Then we have divisions. So there's three divisions of mind and awareness, into seven, into three, and into two. Okay, so we're going to do the one of the division into seven. So the seven are one, direct perceiver, two, inference, three, subsequent cognizer, four, correct assumer, five, inattentive perceivers, six is doubt, and seven is a wrong consciousness. Okay, so then we start with direct perceivers. Okay, so the explanation of direct perceivers has two parts, definitions and divisions. So here we're coming with the definition. An unmistaken knower that is free from conceptuality is the definition of a direct perceiver. So unmistaken, okay, is it's unmistaken in terms of its appearing and observed objects. There is no erroneous element in what is appearing to the consciousness. Yeah?
Ask about that, the way this is used here.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems like you're kind of using the word mistaken in a way that we don't usually use it.
What do you mean?
It seems like they should use the word erroneous.
Okay. When you're talking with about prasangika, there's a difference between mistaken and erroneous. Mm-hmm. When you're talking satantrika, when they say mistaken, it's the same as erroneous.
Oh.
Okay, why is that? Why? Why? Why?
Maybe it has why? To do with direct perception.
Would in prasangika, in what context do we make a difference between mistaken and erroneous?
Appearances and ultimate reality and ultimate nature.
Yeah. So if there's an appearance of true existence, what is it? It's mistaken. If you're grasping that appearance as true, then it's erroneous. Do the satantrikas accept true existence?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. So are they going to make a difference between the appearance of true existence? Are they going to call that a mistaken mind when true existent objects appear to the mind?
No,
are satantrikas going to say that's mistaken?
No. It's not.
Yeah. Okay. So when they say it's mistaken regarding the appearing object, they mean that the scarecrow's appearing like a person.
Yeah.
It's the same as erroneous. Whereas for prasangika, if you say something's mistaken in terms of the appearing object, it usually means that there's the appearance of true existence. Okay? But the satantrikas say there's nothing wrong with the appearance of true existence. True existence exists. That's the correct appearance. It's not mistaken. What are you talking about? Okay? So you could hear right away, you see a big difference in the schools, don't you? Yeah. So what that means is when we look out and everything we see, okay, everything looks like it has its own entity from its own side. You know, that's Jack from his own side. This is a room from the side of the object, right? That's a window from the side of that thing. You know, we don't look at things and think, oh, they depend on causes, or they depend on parts, or they depend on being designated.
So we're all subconscious.
Well, here is why you can see that when you study the different tenet systems, why you start with the lower ones, because they correspond much more to our normal way. Yeah? Because, you know, when we look at things, we don't doubt that what is appearing to us exists, whether it exists the way it appears. We just say, yeah.
And even when we pull it apart, like when we talked about losing Gotami, you know, we pull the whole thing apart, but then our mind just snaps it.
Right, yeah.
Into that building is.
Right. And it's there from its own side. Okay. So, yeah. So the Prasangikas say that's a mistaken appearance. Yeah. The appearance that something has an essence out there from its own side that makes it what it is a mistaken appearance. Yeah. So, yeah. So the Prasangikas say everything we're just perceiving all around us is a mistaken appearance because it appears truly existent, but it isn't. But it's not necessarily erroneous because we can still know a cup is a cup and a carpet is a carpet. We, you know, if we thought the cup was a carpet, that would be erroneous. Okay? But for the Satantrika, they don't question the appearance of true existence.
So this is written from that viewpoint.
Right.
All the way through.
Yeah, unless otherwise specified, this is written from the viewpoint of Satantrika. Yeah?
Why are we comparing category with subcategory? So it's sautantrika, not to Madhyamika, but to the subcategory of Madhyamika, to Prasangika.
When we talk about different schools, there's Vaibhasika, sautantrika, that's the one we're talking about here, Chittamatra,
and
Madhyamika.
So, and Prasangika is under the
Prasangika is a subdivision of Madhyamaka.
So, yeah, my question is, why are we comparing a school to a subdivision?
Oh, because we usually just go, the Prasangika is said to be the highest school, so we just go to that, the highest view, and then we compare everything else to the most correct view. Yeah. Why compare everything to something that's not completely correct? Okay? Okay. So an unmistaken, non-conceptual knower. So unmistaken, yeah, is in terms, it's eliminating conceptual appearances as the appearing object, isn't it? Because as soon as there's a conceptual appearance, from the Satantrika viewpoint, then that's mistaken, isn't it? Okay? So the mistaken is eliminating conceptual consciousnesses whose appearing object is a conceptual appearance. So then when they say the definition, unmistaken, non-conceptual knower, in one way it's redundant. Because unmistaken is the same thing as non-conceptual. Okay? But it says here, free from conception is added to eliminate the non-Buddhist Vaisheshika's view that sense consciousnesses are conceptual. So they put that in because there's some non-Buddhist school that says sense consciousnesses are conceptual. Strange. Yeah? Okay? So an unmistaken knower that is free from conceptuality is the definition of a direct perceiver. Okay, what's an example of a direct perceiver?
Eye sense.
What?
Eye consciousness taking in a form.
Okay, so not consciousness seeing a form. Mm-hmm. Okay, your consciousness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So now we have another definition coming. A new, incontrovertible, unmistaken knower that is free from conceptuality is the definition of a directly perceiving, reliable cognizer. So remember last week we talked about reliable cognizers, mm-hmm. and they are new and incontrovertible. So when you put a direct perceiver that's a reliable cognizer, then you have to have new, incontrovertible, unmistaken, free from conception. All those four things. Okay? So new, yeah. Well, here. A pramana, if you look at the footnote, pramana is the, I translate it as reliable cognizer, said other people do as valid cognizers, or there's lots of different things, okay? So according to a Satantrika, pra of pramana refers to the first moment of the mind that realizes its object by its own power. So that's why Satantrikas, if you translated pramana into English, you usually say like prime cognizer or ideal cognizer. You know, it's something that's the first moment of when you're seeing something, you know, and the consciousness is seeing it by its own power, not seeing it because the preceding moment of mind had seen it. Okay? Yeah. But for Prasangika, pra means main. So there, for Prasangika, it doesn't have to be a new cognizer. It has to be incontrovertible. Does it have to be unmistaken for Prasangika?
To be reliable.
Yes. To be a reliable cognizer?
No, it doesn't. This is the one where they get to have the...
It doesn't have to be unmistaken, because every consciousness of a sentient being, except the wisdom directly perceiving emptiness, is a mistaken consciousness. Okay? So for Prasangika, it doesn't have to be new and it doesn't have to be unmistaken. It has to be incontrovertible. Okay? And the Prasangikas, they also, it doesn't necessarily have to be free from conception either. Yeah? The Prasangikas have a whole different way of talking about these things, but we won't get into that right now. Okay, we'll just study it according to the Satantrika. Okay, a new incontrovertible, so incontrovertible is miluwa in Tibetan, or undeceived. It has eliminated superimpositions on its object and has realized the object. So that means non-erroneous. Incontrovertible is the same as non-erroneous. Okay? Unmistaken knower that is free from conceptuality is the definition of a directly perceiving reliable consciousness. Okay, so when I look at the cup, the first moment of me looking at the cup and seeing pink, is that a reliable direct perceiver?
Yes, the first moment.
Okay. What about the second moment, when I'm looking at it, and the second moment of looking at it and seeing my visual consciousness seeing peak? Is that a direct perceiver?
No.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Yes. Is it a reliable direct perceiver?
No.
No. Okay. If I look at this and I see green, is it a direct perceiver?
Yeah, but it's mistaken. It's erroneous.
Yeah. So is it a reliable cognizer?
No.
No. But it is still a direct perceiver.
Yes.
Okay. Right? Okay. When direct perceivers are divided, there are four. Yeah. Sense, mental, apperception, and yogic direct perceivers. Okay. So sense ones, you know, with the five senses, mental with the mental sense. Apperception we'll get into, but that is a part of the mind that perceives the mind non-dually. And only certain schools believe in it. Okay, so the Satantrikas that are reasoning proponents, the Chittamatras and the Yogacharya Satantrikas assert apperception. Everybody else refutes it. Yeah, and the Prasangikas tear it to bits. They don't like apperception at all, but we'll get into that. But maybe I shouldn't have told you that.
That's the same as self-cognizer?
Self-cognizer, yeah. But the term self-cognizer is sometimes this the word here is translated as self-cognizer, but sometimes you find that term in meaning something totally different, okay? So I think it's better to use apperception. And then a yogic direct perceiver. So those are the four kinds. So we're almost at 7 o'clock. I think it's better to stop before we get into something. Any questions? Yeah.
Can you explain why the second moment is no longer reliable? What is that about?
Well, because they defined it so that the first moment is reliable. Because the first moment realizes the object through its own power. Whereas the second moment, you're depending on the first moment to know the object. So they say it's not, you know, it's like just not as good.
Not as fresh.
Yeah.
Is that hint that conceptuality is starting to creep in there, or it has nothing to do with that?
No.
It's just not as fresh.
It's just not as fresh. Because it's depending on something else rather than the vividness of the first one. But it's just the way that the school chooses to define it. Because for Prasangika, the subsequent cognizers can also be reliable cognizers. Yeah?
How do they define moment? How do they separate first and the
next? Oh, that's a very good question. Yeah? It's never quite sure. Moment is one of those words that you're never quite sure what it means. Because sometimes it means, what is it, 165th of a...
65.
Sometimes it's like 165th. Yeah, sometimes it's 365th. Sometimes moment just means time period. It just means time period.
Let's take a moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they'll say, like, you know, the moment of a liberating path. It doesn't mean that the liberating path is there for 1/365th of a finger snap. It just means for as long as you're meditating with that liberated path.
With time periods, you're designating it.
Yeah, I mean, moment just means whatever you want it to mean at that, you know, in that context.
When we talk about the first moment of cognizing something, does that mean just in a particular continuum of perceiving something as opposed to only the first time seeing it ever?
Yeah. I remember we asked Geshe-la that too, and I can't remember what he responded. Yeah. If it's just the first time you know the object, or if, you know, and then ever after, that's a subsequent cognizer. Or if it's the first in just that particular string. It seems to me that it might be just the first in that particular string because it's knowing it by its own power. So there's something special about starting out a stream of cognizer with that moment of first knowing it. Yeah. But I can't remember exactly what the answer to that is. Yeah?
Maybe a basic question. If you say you see pink when you look at that, if I see red, what does that mean?
Okay. So if I see pink and he sees red, then what? That's not colorblind. Then what? I mean, I'm right, of course. We know that.
I thought your pink was mistaken myself.
You thought this was red? You people. You think it's pink? Yeah. So in something like this, it happens to be something where we're not quite sure what to label it. Yeah? Have you ever thought that when you say, okay, this one we can all agree is red, right?
Yeah.
We all know this is red. But do we know when somebody else sees this that they're seeing the same thing we're seeing? We don't know. We're all calling it red, but they might be perceiving purple or yellow or something else. And they could call it red because in there, that's how it looks. So we all agree it's red, but we may not actually even be perceiving the same thing.
So is that then a direct perception?
Huh?
Is that then a direct perception?
Yeah, it's a direct perception for both people. It's a direct perception. So both of them say, I perceive red. Yeah. But it's just because of different karma, what they actually perceive is different. Yeah. Interesting, isn't it? I always think of a kind of gross example, but it works really well. What we look and we say poop, a fly looks at and says food. Okay? Both are correct, reliable cognizers in terms of the individual being of a specific realm cognizing it. If I said it was food, it would be an erroneous, a wrong cognizer. But if a fly says it's food, it's a correct cognizer for that fly, even though for me it's anything but food. Yeah. So it has to do also with that your karma as a particular sentient being. Okay. And so for the next series of Thursdays, we're going to be having Lamrim teachings. Yeah, which I think will be very good. And you know, try and go a little bit deeper into some of the Lamrim topics. Yeah, and then spend some time meditating on them too. And it might be interesting for you to take some of this stuff from what we've been studying and apply it when you're talking about the Lamrim topics. Yeah? And see how you can bring it in, you know. Because otherwise this stuff just becomes like boring philosophy and you tune it out. Yeah. But, you know, try and bring it into your Lamrim. Mm-hmm. When you're doing Lamrim meditation, are you mostly using direct perceivers or conceptual consciousnesses?
Conceptual consciousnesses.
Conceptual consciousnesses, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Can you perceive your thoughts?
Can you perceive your thought? They say that it's one moment of mind perceiving another moment of mind. Although apperception apprehends that very same mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it is perception. Even though a thought could be conceptual, you could perceive.
Yeah, yeah. It's a consciousness. So you can perceive a consciousness.
A direct perception.
Yeah, somebody with clairvoyance can see what you're thinking about. You don't want them to see what you're thinking.
No, that's not what I was thinking. I was thinking that if you'd have to have a person to actually perceive your own thoughts. But anyway.
No, your thoughts, don't you?
Yes, but if I was just thinking about, I don't know, about apperception. It's like, well, who's looking at the thought then? It just, my mind is kind of like, I don't know, like that. That's all.
Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path
and our spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Guru Anamandala Kanyatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Floor.